In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. It's not a stretch. It's a pretty good intuition that everybody has that what you feel on the inside tends to manifest itself out on the outside. So if you're sad inside, you put on a sad face. And if you're happy on the inside, you're happy on the outside. Well, social psychologists for 150 years have been asking this question. I wonder if you change what's on the outside, whether or not that will change what's on the inside. And they wondered, could you adjust your facial muscles in such a way that, you know, gray skies are going to clear up, put on a happy face, right? Like, is there a cause-effect relationship that way? If you smile a lot, does that make you happier? Guess what, brothers and sisters? In 1988, there was an actual study to test that theory. And what they made some people do was to take a pin and put it in their mouth like this. A frowning face. Right now, my wife is pushing away the gag reflex because she's thinking, did you wash that pen? Right? So they would do this. And they would study them. And then for others, they would make them do this. Right, good. Smile. Smile. Right. And then they would say that. And in 1988, they have the hypothesis. If you do this for long enough, for like 30 minutes a day, that if you go into your interview for a job, like Google interview smile, and you're going to find this study from 1988. The hypothesis, it's proven theory, it gets published in peer-reviewed journals. Proven! Until last year. 2016, they reproduced the study. There's no correlation. And that's all funny. Until you realize that that study is emblematic of a much larger trend within the scientific community these days. If you'll just go to Google and type in the words crisis of reproducibility, you're going to find a whole slew of articles that will tell you, that will demonstrate that over the last few years, they've done these meta studies of previously published peer-reviewed studies, and barely 40% of those studies are reproducible. Meaning, they took the same exact methodology, materials, study, length of time, did everything exactly the same, and not even 40% of them yielded the same results. And that's why they're calling it a crisis of reproducibility. Because look, what is science? Science is the idea that I can test things and I can reproduce things no matter where I am, no matter what time I am, as long as I follow the same instructions. And they're doing that, and they're not finding this convergence of theories, this convergence of studies, and that is a crisis. Now look, put it into perspective. If it were like 3 to 5% of scientific studies not bearing out the truth, no big deal. Science isn't perfect, no scientific study is perfect. But when you're talking about up to 60% of studies not reproducing the same results, that's a crisis. And the stuff they're studying is not the sort of esoteric stuff that nobody matters. These are the kinds of studies that they invest millions of dollars in and then publish in peer-reviewed journals, and then people base their lives on these studies. This is a big deal. Now, let's be clear here. Okay, I'm not trying to fulfill the evangelical stereotype that's trying to throw science under the bus. On the contrary, I need science. I would not even be able to see you today without science. Okay? There's a million things that we benefit from through the way of the scientific enterprise. So that's not what I'm criticizing here, lest any of you run with that theory. Okay? What I am saying is this, that there's something going on within the scientific enterprise that's at flaw. But I'm not raising that question to call out science. I'm actually raising it to illustrate a phenomenon that is actually kind of originates from the philosophy tradition, and it's this word consilience. Say it. Consilience. And right now, all of you are going, wow, isn't he a very clever man to use such a big word? I used that word in a sentence for the very first time 10 seconds ago. Okay? Consilience is this. It's the idea that if you will take multiple threads of inquiry, multiple studies, multiple ways of research, that those ought to converge and corroborate and self-report and self-validate one another. That educators and teachers and scientists of all stripes would suggest or would hope that the more you do more science from a variety of fields, those answers are going to come together and provide this consensus. But what this whole crisis of reproducibility is showing is there's no consilience. There's no convergence of threads. Things are diverging here, and that is a crisis. It leads you into darkness when there isn't a corroboration of evidence. Now, that's one big setup for trying to make this point, that the issue that Jesus is going to raise today, anachronistically speaking, is a matter of consilience or the absence thereof. That there are issues that are not related to the material world, but are related to our spiritual yet embodied life. Ideas, things that ought to converge, but in fact are diverging. And when they diverge, it's a crisis. That which ought to converge is not. And when it doesn't, it's a darkness. And we need to confront it. And moreover, we need to figure out what will reunite that which is diverged. We are nearing the end of our study of the Sermon on the Mount. Every week has been dedicated to asking one question. What is Jesus out to reimagine for us this week? In this passage, from these verses, I think Jesus is out to reimagine for us the cruciality of consilience. So, that's a lot. That's a mouthful. Would you stand? We're in chapter 7. Chapter 7, starting in verse 15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, and a diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will come to me and say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not cast out demons in your name? Did we not do many mighty works in your name? And then I'll declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has said a number of things to us in a number of ways. He has spoken provocatively. He's spoken pointedly. This morning, he speaks soberingly. He uses words that are meant to compel those who hear to great introspection and reflection. These words would still us, would silence us, would steel us for a kind of responsiveness. And the question is, what is he out to sober us about? He begins those sobering words with one warning, such that he front-loads his very passage with the first word, beware. Beware of false prophets who come to you as sheep, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. What's he getting at there? Let's consider the context a little for just a moment, okay? It's going to be decades before everything that ends up comprising the New Testament is even written. It's going to be 300 years before the church ever comes to some form of consensus about what should comprise the best books that form the Old and New Testament, the Bible. They call it the canon. There's no consensus on that. Into that milieu, anybody who sounds authoritative can walk into one of these fledgling church communities and begin to sound very authoritative. They can have wisdom, they can have knowledge, they can have charisma, they can have charm. And Jesus is saying, anybody can give off any kind of that. And yet they can also be covering something up, telling only part of the truth, underscoring certain aspects of some ideas that he might have shared in the past, but to the expense of other ideas as well. And so Jesus is outlining a principle here. And he is saying, those who have true prophetic authority, those who have the right to speak with authority, those whom we might give our authority to hear, listen to their voice, they should also have a character that backs up what they might have to say. And where you don't see that, you ought to run. And quickly. And therefore, Jesus pulls up this very vivid image of botany. It is botanically impossible for any tree that is good to put forth shriveled fruit. It is impossible for any tree that is diseased to bring forth that which you should eat, that which has a succulence to it. It's obvious. You almost wonder, why is Jesus having to say it? And yet Jesus is having to say it because, look, brothers and sisters, you and I can be taken in. Taken in by a lot of things that give off all the appearances of trustworthiness, of validity, of importance, and yet be totally blind to that which they wish to obscure in themselves. Some apparent authority belies the absence of its therefore. That is true of that age into which Jesus is speaking. That is true of every age, this age, and forevermore. Sinclair Lewis writes Elmer Gantry back in the 20th century. And there lies perhaps the most potent, poignant, modern rendition of a failed and false prophet, Elmer Gantry. And so I have a quote from that novel on the front of your bulletin at the top of Elmer Gantry. It was said he had, in fact, got everything from the church and Sunday school, except perhaps any longing whatever for decency and kindness and reason. You can see the movie with Burt Lancaster. He gives off this great persona of authority and magnanimity and holiness, when in truth he is just as much a huckster as anybody trying to sell snake oil. And that was true then, brothers and sisters, it's true now. And therefore, what Jesus is saying to his disciples then is a principle that is just as applicable now, a principle of responsibility for anybody that is going to listen to somebody that speaks with authority, and it's this. If you're going to give anybody's voice authority, you better exercise some discernment about whether they're worth that authority. Now, that's pretty much obvious, okay? That's the whole practice what you preach axiom that we like to talk about often, right? And so when it comes back to our original word of consilience, what ought to converge that Jesus' warning diverges too often? It's the convergence of profession and procession. The convergence of profession and what seeps from you, what is most evident from you. And from that convergence, from that consilience that Jesus is trying to bring forth or to restore, I think there's two implications, one that's really obvious and one that's more subtle. The real obvious one is this, like I've just said, the voices you listen to require that you would inspect for their procession before you ever give them authority of their profession. You have to listen to what they say. You have to learn from what they hear. You have to be careful about who you listen to. And that is true of every politician you might vote for. Hear that, brothers and sisters. Of every CEO you might ever invest in. Of every teacher you might sit under. And brothers and sisters, of every pastor you might ever give counsel from. Let me just use a really present example. We started our intro to CTK class last week. It continues this week. And at the end of it, those who want to stand for membership, the elders of this church will sit down with them and kind of, we call it an interview. That's really a bad name for it. It's just sort of a, let us hear your story and let us hear how you understand the gospel and let us hear how you understand what it means to be a member. So the elders of this church will in effect interview you. But you know what? What does this text say? If you're going to join this church, not only do you have a right, you have a responsibility to interview us. You have the right to ask us some questions. What is the fruit of this church? What is the fruit of your pastor, of your assistant pastor, of your session? Now we're getting in there, right? That's your responsibility. That's your mandate to protect you. and to protect the peace and purity of this church. That's the very obvious example, the very obvious implication of this principle. Here's the one that's more subtle. He's talking to his disciples. Brothers and sisters, you know who this passage is talking to? It's talking to me. I have to inspect my own heart. Kevin has to inspect his own heart. The session has to inspect their hearts. What is most evident in us? What comes from us most readily? And what does that indicate? I have to ask myself those questions. The session has to ask me those questions. The session alike have to ask each other those questions. And the question that we have to ask is, what is the fruit of my faith? That's a subtler implication. The other subtler implication is this, brothers and sisters, the mandate to manifest consilience between our profession and our procession is not confined to the clergy. It's every one of yours' mandate. The question that I have to ask myself is the same question you have to ask yourself. What is the fruit of your faith? What is proceeding? What is most evident? Look, you're here. That's great. You greeted one another with smiles. Fantastic. You've sung. You've prayed. Love that. Fabulous. You've spoken other languages. Thank you, Kyria. But what is most evident in you? What's true of you when no one's looking? What's true of you when you leave here? That's your procession. And Jesus is asking us to ask ourselves, what is the fruit of your faith? Because fruit matters. The whole love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, that's not a throwaway text. That's a barometer of your heart. The whole love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, that's not something we embroider. It's something we embrace because fruit matters. Brothers and sisters, what is the fruit of your faith? Dallas Willard has a quote on the front of your bulletin that is also sobering. He says this. Second quote there. Spirituality in many Christian circles has simply become another dimension of Christian consumerism. We have generated a body of Christian people who consume Christian services and think that that is Christian faith. Consumption of Christian services replaces obedience to Christ. Ouch! What's he saying? He's saying this. It's a lot easier to ingest than it is to digest. It's a lot easier to go for information, but not to actually seek transformation. It's a lot easier to listen to sermons than to reflect on whatever there might be a gap between your profession and your procession. What does that mean? It means that friends and spouses ought to be able to ask those questions of one another. You ought to be able to do that. It means our community group facilitators and our community groups, as you get to know one another, that ought to be on the agenda at some point. Where's the gap in your heart? Where do you feel it? Where do you sense it? And we're not doing that so that somebody can record on a little tally sheet, oh, Doug's having this kind of problem. It's an acknowledgement. It's an inquiry that's all about trying to retrace our steps and to figure out, to account for, why is there a discrepancy between my profession and my procession? To do that is a matter of love. It's an act of love. It's not an act, well, around here we call it holy nosiness. There is such a thing. You sound like a paradox. It's not. It's love. What is the fruit of your faith? That's a sobering question that Jesus is putting to us. But brothers and sisters, while it is sobering, it ought not be besetting. What's the difference? Sobering is, wow. Besetting is like, oh, there's a difference. Jesus is out to sober us. He's not out to beset us. Why the difference? Hang on. It's in the second point, the second thread of consilience or the lack thereof. Okay? What he says in verses 21 through 23 is the most sobering, if not alarming, words he has said in the entire sermon. And when you heard it, you might have gotten a little shiver because he said, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven. Now, that's sobering in its own right to think that there'll be a separation between a person and the Lord. That's there will be a judgment. That is sobering in its own right. But what makes this utterly sobering, in the last point, Jesus is warning about an absence of fruitfulness. In this point, he's actually imagining a scenario where there are people who give off every appearance of fruitfulness. And yet there's something wrong. There's something profoundly wrong. These people that in this next passage, they're not just doing the mere talk thing. This is not just flapping their gums. There's action. They're not passive people. They are going for the gusto. They are running on all 12 cylinders, it would seem. Such that Jesus envisions this sort of hypothetical scenario where he says, not everybody who comes to me on that day saying, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. And they make this case. They whip out their spiritual resume and they say, wait a minute. Surely there's an error in your spreadsheet. Did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not do the exorcisms in your name? Did we not do many mighty works in your name? Surely there's a mistake, an accounting error. And Jesus says, there's no accounting error here. He says, on that day I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Most sobering thing he said the whole time. And in that one verse, he utters a very sobering paradox with a very fearful prospect. The sobering paradox is this. There is a kind of spiritual effort, of ministry activity, that is diametrically opposed to the heart and will of God. It has all the appearances of faithfulness when it is actually the opposite thereof. An ostensible faithfulness that Jesus is saying is both invalid but also impertinent. That's the sobering paradox from which follows a fearful prospect, and that is a judgment and a separation, a distance, an estrangement. But what exactly comprises that fruitfulness that's actually a rottenness? What is he talking about? One clue, if you just sort of think a little while about those sort of three things they rattle off as part of their spiritual resume, they're all very public, and they all sound very impressive. And our go-to commentator on this passage and other passages, F.D. Bruner, says, you know what? You know what's common to all of those things? They're all very much in the limelight. They're all things that people like to be seen about. And what's missing from their resume are the simple, unheralded, messy, sacrificial, loving acts that no one will talk about except the ones for whom it was done, if them at all. Dietrich Bonhoeffer on this one verse says, Jesus is talking about a discipleship that is devoid of love and therefore devoid of Christ. Which is sort of a motif in this sermon that we've heard before. And that's why we have recounted what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13 when he says, if I speak with the tongues of men of angels and have not love, I am nothing. I'm a clanging cymbal. If I give up my body to be burned, if I give everything away, but I have not love, I am nothing. And so Jesus says to them, I never knew you. What he's saying to them is that these people, these imaginary people, are guilty of spiritual name dropping. You know what name droppers do, right? They like to say, oh, I hung out with George W. Bush last week. Oh, yeah, really? Yeah, I'm sure Greg Gorman did. Yeah, yeah. Oh, wait, he did, actually. Sorry, that doesn't count. Yeah, I hung out with Ken Myers yesterday. Who's Ken Myers? Well, if you only knew, right? Spiritual name dropping. Like, it gives this impression that, like, you're buddies. Like, that you're stuck on each other. No, it just means you voice their name. That's name dropping. And Jesus is saying, you folks, you're all about name dropping. But there's this activity that you're talking about that belies an absence of intimacy. And so when it talks about consilience, when we're talking about consilience here, there ought to be a consilience between our activity and our intimacy. And Jesus is talking about the absence thereof. And he's saying that ought sober you. In our RV, we have the proverbial hula girl on the dashboard, right? She's fully clothed. Everything's great. Okay. She's wearing the lei, right? When the RV shakes, she shakes, right? I've forever besmirched this pulpit. When the RV turns, she turns, right? She's a fixture in the RV, but she is absolutely inconsequential to the operation. Brothers and sisters, Jesus can be like the hula girl in the RV. Oh, a visible presence in your midst, but entirely inconsequential to the operation. Brothers and sisters, do you invite Jesus into the innermost places of your heart? Do I? Do you consult him for the plans that you might make? Is he the driving force behind everything you do? Is it his glory that is driving you to do what you do? Or is there something else that's really the MO, that's really beneath everything that you're doing? Because it can be. Oh, it can be. And that's the warning he's giving us. We ask the question in the first point, what is the fruit of your faith? In the second point, Jesus is asking us this question, what is the faith of your fruit? What are you really believing in order to motivate your acting? What does your effort really reveal about your motivations? See, in any given thing, you can delight in the labor itself. You can love doing that. Or you can delight in the admiration that might come by way of it. And whereas that is in itself not intrinsically fiendish, there is a way of letting that become most prominent in why you do what you do. And therefore, when it comes to living for the Lord, you can either delight in doing what pleases Him, or you can actually get juiced by every public thing you get in return for that and let that be what is your motivation. That is what juices you. And Jesus is saying, if you prefer that, then I have the most sobering words I could ever speak to another human when he says to us, I never knew you. There is an absence of consilience that Jesus is warning us about. Between profession and procession, between activity and intimacy, which all then asks this question, what will restore it? Brothers and sisters, as I said in the first point, that we ought to be sobered by it, but not beset by it. And in the same way here, we ought to be sobered by the absence of consilience between activity and intimacy, but not beset by it. Why? Here's my last point. What brings these together? Why ought you only be sobered but not beset? It's this, and I think it's actually embedded in that second warning. Embedded in the warning is an implicit encouragement that you need to catch. The way to seeing consilience restored along those lines of inquiry is this. In those most dispiriting words that one might ever hear from Jesus, implicit in that is the most inspiring words. If in saying, I never knew you, what does that indicate about what Jesus' most important desire for us is? That I want to know you. He doesn't say, I wasn't king over you, depart from me. He didn't say, I wasn't here to save you and rescue you, depart from me. He did both of those things. He's interested in both of those things. What did he say? I never knew you. And therefore, what he means for us is that he wants to know us. Now, let's be really clear. That does not mean that he is saying, you know, I want to get to know you. I really don't know you very well. We should go for coffee. That's not what Jesus is saying. It's not like anything is unknown to him. What I mean by knowing you or us being known by him is that he wants to be in communion with us. But before we get all spiritual sounding, what does it mean to know, but to be known by somebody? What does it mean for anyone else to know you, to really know you? It means that they know your strengths and your weaknesses. It means that they know your triumphs and your bitter disappointments. It means that they know your accomplishments and your royal screw-ups. And the reason they know those things is because you have laid yourself bare before them. You've made yourself transparent in those ways. And why have you found the courage to be that transparent before them? Because you have come to believe that they are for you. You know that they know you because you believe that they're for you. For Christ to place such a premium on Him knowing us is the clearest evidence that He is for us. If God did not spare His own Son, but gave Him up for us all, then how will He not give us all things with Him? Brothers and sisters, what really accounts for why there might be fruitlessness in your life? What would really explain why there might be an absence of peace or patience or kindness or gentleness? Why would there be an absence of love in your heart? It's because deep down, you don't believe He's for you. Why might someone prefer to try to impress the Lord rather than just to trust Him? Why might they be secretly worried that they have to garner an acceptance either from somebody that they know or by aiming for some sort of public effort at the expense of private faithfulness? Why might they be motivated to act in that way? Because deep down, they don't trust that Christ is for them. Brothers and sisters, He warns whom He loves. He sobers up those whom He cherishes. Take it from this man who became 45 yesterday, who upon reflection just began to acknowledge yesterday in his journal, you know what? Whatever 45 was supposed to feel like, I don't feel like 45. I don't feel like I ought to have the maturity of what a 45-year-old is. Such that as I'm fixing my tie this morning, what does my wife find in my shirt? This giant gaping hole in my shirt right there. Brothers and sisters, we've all got a hole in our shirt. Metaphorically speaking. Taken from this guy who knows what it's like to struggle with an absence of fruitfulness, who knows what it's like to bear fruit in an utterly self-centered way. What will restore consilience between those two things? It will be because we know that He is for us. He proved that in His words and His sermon. He proved that in His life, His death, and His resurrection. And He proves that with His Spirit that He leaves with us, that reproduces that truth in us over and over for all our days, that we might not enter into it a crisis. Smiling more will never make you more sanguine. But taking Jesus at His word, reflecting on what He said, and putting it into practice, that will reunite what is diverged in you. Let's pray. Father, help us to see the gap. And then help us to understand why we don't trust You. And then help us know why we can. That we might live again, united with consilience of heart and mind and hands. Amen.